Welcome to the 2018 Bay Area Book Festival. This is Sherilyn Parsons, founder and director of the festival. Enjoy the conversation.
Welcome to our panel at the Bay Area Book Festival. Our panel is, we are all from California College of the Arts, MFA writing program. And first of all, I just want to thank everyone for coming out this morning on a Saturday morning and not sleeping in. And I also want to thank the book festival, and I also want to ask all of you to silence your cell phones, if you can, before we get started. Or else whoever calls will have to have a really good question for us that we can take. So, yeah. So this is a pretty dazzling, in my opinion, group of panelists here with a wide range of writing talents. Leslie Carroll Roberts is our chair over at CCA and the MFA of Writing Program, is a wonderful nonfiction writer. Then Tanya Foster is our wonderful poet in the program. And we'll get into where we're from and what we do. Faith Adiele is a memoirist and teaches creative nonfiction for us. And Amy Fahn is a short story writer and terrific novelist. So just a wide range of writing experiences. I'm Tom Barbash. I teach in the program as well. I'm a novelist, short story writer, and written nonfiction as well. And so what we're talking about now, I guess, when we thought about the panel, we described it as a writer's materials, politics, responsibilities, sort of who we are as writers. And so I wanted to sort of talk about the journey that we all go on. And one of them is, the first thing is the desire to write. And then I guess there's when you want to write and you start to learn how to write, then you have to sort of figure out what you want to write. At some point, you ask the question of who you are. And for a lot of us, for me, that wasn't really connected to what I wrote about originally. So that was a sort of longer journey for me, and I'm curious with our panelists how they got to it. And then there's a sense of where you're from, and where you are, your relationship to your surroundings, and then your relationship to a sort of larger political universe. And all along the way, I guess you're searching for your most important essential material and your relationship to it, who you are, on the page, who you are in the world. And so I guess it's kind of open question, but I wanted to just begin with that, sort of who you were when you started writing, and a little bit, you know, talk a little bit about your path, and maybe beginning with Amy Fahn, if you could begin.
Thank you. Thank you, the Bay Area Book Festival, and thank you, Tom, for helping guide this discussion. I think the idea of our panel was really interesting because I think we're, I don't know, at least for the, was it last 2 years, year and a half, I think our world has changed so much, right? And our perspective has changed, and I feel like we're experiencing the long-term consequences of what our new world is and how we're going to function in it. And at least for me as a writer, who I am as a writer and who I am as a human being and in my other roles in like this life, have become more anxious, have become more stressed, and have, I think, prompted me to focus on why, what I want to do here. What I want to do here as a human being, what I want to do as a writer. I think when I first started out writing, you know, I started writing short stories. I mean, I was talking to people at the, you know, at, I think, the gala last night at the Bay Area Book Festival. We often start to write just because we love words. We love to read, and this is how we can make sense of the world. But when you're young, you don't know that much yet. You know, you're innocent. Your parents and the adults around in your life have protected you. And the things you discover become your source material. And so it becomes this active discovery of what do I want to write about? What can I learn? And how can I create a world around it? And I think as I've gotten older and as, you know, our world has changed, I feel more inundated with information. And I feel like maybe we all do, right? Like the first time I was learning to write, I was prompted, go into a bookstore. And I would go into a used bookstore and I would look up at all these ancient books. And they said, that is how you learn to be a writer. Now I feel it's very different. Writers now maybe that's one option, but they also have an option that's right inside their pocket and in their purse of reading on the phone, reading on the internet. And so what do you do with all that information? I think that has become a huge question for me about not necessarily discovery, but choosing what slice of the world, what slice of history am I going to tackle and confront and try to make sense of as a writer. So when I first started writing, yes, like I was trying to write about people and subject matters that I had not read about. I hadn't read about Vietnamese Americans. I hadn't read about a lot of Asian Americans. One of the first seminal Asian American books I read was The Road to Manzanar. And it blew my mind, the idea of a story with a novel centering on a young Japanese American girl. Because growing up, I didn't realize that my perspective or people who look like me, our perspective could be important or could be worthwhile in a book. And so that became a little bit of my fuel of, this is what I can write. This is what I can contribute to the world. I can tell people what it was like to grow up in my family or what it was like to grow up as a young, you know, daughter of Vietnamese refugees in Orange County. Like, this is a story that maybe other people would be interested in. Now I think, in 2018, Vietnamese American literature has really flourished. We've got Viet Nguyen, who had The Sympathizer, and we have so many different writers, not only in the Vietnamese diaspora, but the Asian diaspora and like writers of color. There are a multitude of voices, and so I think for me the next step is trying to figure out, again, like my focus of what specifically can I contribute, and what can I write about, and what can I say. And so I guess that's my starting off point in terms of like the future now. Like, I think I've written two books that I think encompass what impressed upon me in childhood. And now with my third book, and you know, hopefully in the future, other books are, how am I going to deal with the modern world? And so the book I'm writing now is incredibly contemporary, and I'm hoping I can write it fast enough so that history doesn't change too much. Like, I'm writing about contemporary Vietnam, and I'm writing about IVF and different ways of reproduction after the war, and how people can make families, you know, 30 years after the war, 30, 40 years after it. Is
that good? I think, yeah, and we'll go next to Faith, but that idea of a moment, you know, when you're young, when you read something and realize that maybe someone might be interested in your story, it's a huge moment. And I'm wondering if all of you had that moment, you know, at some point. But Faith, do you want to carry on?
Sure. Good morning, everyone. I'm glad that you talked about, as you know, when you first started writing, what purpose that served. I think in my house, books were actually involved in parenting. And so I was raised in rural Washington State, and I'm biracial, and I was raised by my white mom in a, you know, predominantly kind of white rural community where people didn't read so much as, you know, drive large trucks over things. And so the whole, her, you know, so once a year she would like go to Seattle and buy like every book that had like a brown face in it and just like come back with, you know, and so I just, so, you know, I just like kind of read my way to sanity and read my way to think that, you know, there were folks of color out there, there were biracial folks out there, there were African folks out there, there were women leaders. And so I really kind of, that's the world that I immersed myself in and just hoped that, you know, eventually I could get out of my town and meet my tribe. And so I started writing kind of in response to that, writing poetry. I was always interested in nonfiction, in truth. I wasn't interested in, even though I entered these fictional worlds, I wasn't interested in writing fiction. And so then I think, you know, when I went away to college, I stopped writing because it seemed impractical. But when I was doing research for my thesis and I was studying Buddhist nuns in Thailand, I became really interested in whose narratives get told and whose don't. And everyone was telling me that women's narratives didn't matter. And so, of course, I knew that I had to write them because that's what I love to do. Whatever you tell me I can't do. And so that became really interested in how I could use my connection to these women and these, the fact that I was able to enter into this space that most Westerners didn't have access to, a Buddhist nun, and collect women's stories. And they somehow seemed connected to this history of stories I had grown up with alternative histories and people of color histories, women histories. And so I wanted to, you know, move away from anthropology, which is what I was studying, and really put it into the creative realm. And so that's when I shifted and left anthropology and figured out that I should go back to my love of writing. And then from that, I started looking at my family history and became really fascinated in how we can use personal stories to read history and how historical events and politics can be read in the family and in the body. So then I started researching what had happened with my grandparents immigrating from Europe and becoming white in America. And then the civil rights movement, which brought my parents together and kind of how they thought they were going to transform the world. And today we see that transformation wasn't complete. And then the African independence movement and the Nigerian civil war, which is what split up my family when my father disappeared. And so I became really interested in how I could follow my social and political interests through narrative, through family stories. I'd been doing lots of, I'd been running a nonprofit. I had been working with young people on training them to do this work around the world. And I just noticed that narrative was how we communicated with each other. Before we made a big decision about policy, people told stories about where they came from, what mattered to them. That's how we built trust to build movements. And so I eventually decided to leave that work and really, or leave that space and do that work through writing, because everything significant that was happening in my personal life and in understanding history in this country and in communicating with other people happened through story. So that's why I write nonfiction, and that's also why I ostensibly write memoir, which is ostensibly about myself, but I see it as locating my body in this world and commenting on everything that's going on. Does that make sense?
It does, and what interests me is, and I'm wondering if you could just quickly talk about it, is I think of two paths. One, usually ordinarily the one of self-discovery of who you are, and then the path of developing the skills to be a writer. But yours seem to be developing simultaneously, because the self-discovery was part of your process as a nonfiction writer. And that's interesting. But was there any separation? I mean, did you have a sense of yourself as a writer before you figured out who you were? And that's sort of, because I sort of do. I sort of have a sense of myself. Okay, I want to write, but not really knowing who I was until later. But it sounds like yours was kind of at the same time a little bit.
Though I think that training in poetry was really key to, you know, I think we should all be studying poetry just to, you know, to really, it's absolutely key to kind of understand words and white space and the image and all that power. And so I think I was acting as a camera. Same when I was doing the anthropological project with the Buddhist nun, so really observing what's around me and how setting and environment can contribute to the mood. So in that sense, that was my writerly training, my craft training, before I realized what my subject matter was.
Right. Tanya?
Thank you for the question. Good morning. Are you out there? I'm trying to think of where I would start. I'm from New Orleans, or I grew up in New Orleans. I was born in Illinois. I speak with the voice that my mother read to me in. And so for me, there's something central about the sonic. In New Orleans, people were often saying, "Where are you from?" And it was, "I'm from here," but I never had that accent. I talked the way my mother read to me. I was also a kid who was so shy, I walked down the street reading. Because in New Orleans, everyone has to, you say hello, how are you doing? And so I would just be in the book. But I also was reading in the bed at night after my mother said it's time to go to sleep. So I was immersed in books, and there are many things that kind of come to mind for me. On the one hand, I was reading all the books in my elementary and middle school library, right? And I had, in second grade, I think, a teacher who had studied with Kenneth Koch, who did this kind of teachers and writers thing for young kids. And so I think that I started writing poetry then. My father says that I, as a very young kid, said, "Well, I'm going to be a writer, but I'm going to be a lawyer too because I'm not into poverty. And so the very young me understood something about, I mean, we are a very working class family and didn't really see writing as a real possibility in terms of path. But so there were the books that I was reading in middle school, right? And so we're talking Amiri Baraka, Gwendolyn Brooks, Claude McKay, these things I'm kind of eating up. And then I, in the eighth grade, I became a student at the New Orleans Center for Creative Arts. And suddenly I'm reading Lolita, The Painted Bird, all of these sort of poets and writers, and it becomes this other tradition of literature that I become familiar with. And I'm also reading Gerard Manley Hopkins and John Donne and becoming fascinated with the kind of sounds, the sonic possibilities in that. So you have, on the one hand, the, for me, the sound of New Orleans. And on the other hand, you have the sonic possibilities for what the English language can do, what can be made to happen. And I don't realize that I don't think I'm a poet. I just think I like writing stuff. And there are these many different audiences, right? So there's the church where I grew up, where, you know, they'd have me write a poem and I'd recite the poem to the congregation. And people would say, oh, lovely, and that kind of thing. Then there was the school where I would write my poems and discuss the poems and the kinds of things we were working on and write about art. And then there was the world of books where I would, I mean, I was reading constantly. And so that's sort of my formation as a writer. I think that I don't know that, I guess I was always thinking about identity, but identity actually through the sonic. I once fell in love with a man because he sounded like he was from New Orleans. Mm-hmm. And he would say my name like someone from New Orleans. And so that sort of sense of finding one's place in sound, mm-hmm. finding one's home in sound, is kind of central to how I operate as a poet. That for me, there's the association between word and image, or sound, I should say, and image. That the sonic, what is it? Moten calls it the sonic emergence, but there's the, or he calls it, actually, it's the phonic trace, something like that. But there's this, just sound for me, calls up other sounds, but also suggests multiple possibilities at the same time. And I became this kind of writer who writes by hearing.
Tanya, yeah. When along your path did that happen? I mean, was there a long time where you didn't find that sound, you know, and then you did, or was it fairly early on you made that realization?
No, it took a long time. I mean, I moved to New York, and I would wander around to these various poetry communities, and I thought, God, writers are a weird bunch. Why are these people so strange? And I would call my friends who were not writers and say, my God, what is this? And describe what was going on. And I moved to New York, and I would go to different reading series. I go to the 92nd Street Y. I go to the Poetry Project. I go to these very different poets and just sit in the back and listen. And then I began to be moved by, I realized that I was responding to sound in this way, and that listening to poetry called up other poetry for me.
Nice.
And it's the case in the essays as well.
Yeah. Nice. Leslie?
Yeah, so I have a very distinct and clear memory of being a young girl on my first trip to California. I grew up outside of Washington, D.C. My father was a news reporter, so I grew up in a news household. And we came out to California, and we were staying in a large home on the Pacific Ocean that was owned by a couple my father had met on one of his many, many reporting trips. He'd been in the Bosphorus, and he met the person who had started the largest like chain of burglar alarm companies in Orange County. This is back in the 70s, and they were fabulously wealthy. And the other half of the house was shared by a Disney producer. And this Disney producer used to have these crazy parties. So as a little girl who was growing up in rural Maryland, California was just so, I couldn't believe it. I said, what is this place? And then one day, my dad came and woke up me and my three sisters, my mom, and said, we have to go to Fresno. We're like, Fresno, where's that? There'd been a spectacular crime committed in the town of Chowchilla. And my father was a reporter with the Wall Street Journal. And they called him from New York and they said, Ed, get in your car and go to Chowchilla. A school bus full of children has vanished. So we got into this car and we drove to Chowchilla and checked into a Holiday Inn in Fresno. And I thought Fresno was the greatest place I'd ever seen in my life. And when I first moved to California in 1989, a few months before the earthquake, I'd been living overseas in Bangkok, and my only other experience with California really was Fresno. And people in San Francisco would say, what do you think of California? I'd say, well, you know, Fresno is really beautiful. I still have very fond memories.
There might
of Fresno.
Be some Fresno folks in the audience that
yeah,
don't laugh
well, it
too
is.
Much.
Yeah, I mean, so. I just remember how blue the sky was. But anyway, every night my father would come back from Chowchilla to this Holiday Inn, and he would tell us what they were attempting to figure out about this crime. And I would sit on the floor of the bathroom of the Holiday Inn with my bright pink AM radio listening to the news reports. And it was in those moments, sitting on that cold, hard tile, that I became captivated by the stories of the world. And while I'm a nonfiction writer and I appear in all of my work, I write in the first person, I am always the nominal subject. And I am very interested in everything that happens around both big events and small events. My first book about the Antarctic, The Entire Earth and Sky, very much speaks to a lot of the things that I really did start thinking about when I was in Fresno, which is all the things that happen on the perimeter of the big events, all these smaller things that happen. So I had gone to sea in the Antarctic as a reporter, and I became captivated not by the big stories of like Robert Falcon Scott or Ernest Shackleton, these big sort of things that like they're a stick of dynamite, they blow up everything else in the room with their stories, but the small stories of the simple seamen who were on my ship, people who had left the safety of home and family because they believed that we had a right as individuals to have our voices heard to save the world around environmental things. And I was captivated by them. I was captivated by how we don't hear a lot of those types of stories. So, you know, when Tom for just posed this question, I was thinking, gosh, when did it start? And I really do think it started with Chowchilla and everything that was going on there. Yeah, I think I'll just stop there.
Yeah, that's great. Well, we started by saying a little bit, and Amy spoke to, the challenge of writing in this new world where politics are in our face, on our, you know, in our Facebook feeds, everywhere around us. And so one of the things, I've just completed a novel set in 1980, and one of the nice things was that I could duck out of this year and go live in another year. So, but in some ways I realized I was circling around to some of the same things that are happening now. I was finding echoes of what's happening now. So I guess my question, it's an open-ended question, whoever wants to answer it, is do you go straight at it if you feel the responsibility, the obligation to talk about what's going on here, to express it in art? Or is the best way to end around, to write about something completely different? I had a professor, Doug Unger, I think, who you know, Amy, from Las Vegas, and I remember him saying that someone had told him, he became a writer in the age of Vietnam, and someone preached to him, if you want to write about Vietnam, write about the War of the Cows, he said to us, which is just his way of saying, you'll end up writing about it no matter what you write about. So what do you guys think of in terms of that, of going straight at it or figuring out that there's no way you're going to end up writing about it anyway?
I'm a slow writer. I think there's 8 years between my first and second book. My first book was, the first book was fast because I think I had many years of thinking about a project, but so if you have that long of a time, of course a book I think is going to transform from its origin and inspiration, and other ideas are going to develop. I think writing is like walking through a very dark forest. You walk towards the bright spots, but you circle around for a while. And sometimes the best writing is when you're circling and trying to figure it out. So when I was mentioning about this next, the current project I'm working on, it came out of several like stories I heard from NPR on the radio when I'm driving into my commute and ideas. But what was freeing about the third project was I didn't exactly know what exactly it was going to be about. And as a writer, like for me, that was really fun after doing two really prescriptive projects that I knew exactly what I thought I was going to do, even though you know they changed later. But what was neat about as I would go from chapter to chapter in this draft that I'm writing now, I thought, okay, I want to write about contemporary Vietnam, what it's like to live there 40 years later with characters who have no memory of the war, and they're just kind of dealing with the ghosts, right? But as I was writing it, and I was writing about this girl and her her father and her love of books, and you know, and she works in an IVF clinic, the story started changing. Other characters started coming in, and I realized I was allowing those changes to happen, and it was actually indeed inspired by the politics and the changing climate around us. And that was kind of fun and interesting to realize, like, I didn't have to be frozen in a specific time. And it also speaks to the fact that so many things happening socially and politically now, they're not new. History is certainly repeating itself in different iterations. And I think about that now in terms of how did I feel growing up in the 80s when when people around us were scared of Reagan? Like, is it the same fear we're experiencing now in the age of Trump? So I really like the idea, like, suddenly now I'm dealing with, like, political prisoners and poets who have been silenced in the new book. I am dealing with characters who go off and are exiled into Russia in the 1980s because they aren't allowed to speak in Vietnam. And so even if I thought I was writing a story about a woman who just worked in an IVF clinic, it started transforming in a way that, you know, I was allowing the characters, and it always happens, when you have characters in downtime talking, they talk about the things that are in your subconscious. And so those things emerge in a really nice way, and it's great when, you know, those things can happen. And so it's never, I don't feel like it's direct. I feel for me like it's always just...
And don't you feel like you can almost be more open and truthful when you're not going directly at it? I mean, it's easier to land on those truths. I'm always wary of my own deep-seated opinions. You know, I don't want to have a book that's a rant. You know,
right?
So.
Right. And I think it's especially if you decide. And I'm always scared of like the character who is like too loud, like writing and centering on that. And so I'll often have like a side character come in, and that character emerges, and it's the questions, and it's the dialogue, and going in between them that you realize that more interesting, subtle things can come out.
Yeah. I'm going to disagree and agree. because I think different audiences, different moments in time require different approaches. I remember I was teaching at the Pan-African Conference in Ghana, where Tanya and I met so many years ago, and I was teaching a nonfiction workshop, and it was half African students and half primarily Black American students who thought it was going to be great when they returned to the motherland, but folks were not speaking the same language. And one of the things was the American students had come out of the MFA programs, and they were all about craft, and the African students are like, I'm writing this thing because I want my friend to be let out of jail now. I don't have time for a metaphor. And so there was this push and pull of what is the role of of language and of writing, and if you're being straightforward, is it a polemic, and do you have to be more seductive? And it was a really interesting space, because I thought, you know, there are times when, you know, you need to read poetry or your story in the middle of a marketplace and get people so riled up that they storm the gates. And then there are other times where you're trying to create, I think we're all trying to create literary craft that will transcend the individual political moment and will speak across generations, because these things keep happening over and over again. And so I think there's room for all of that. Another thing that's come up for me in teaching is that often those of us who are representing marginalized communities, our stories are read as political, and other stories are just read as kind of normative human universal experiences. And so I'm always trying to get people to think that your body is a politicized site. Anything that you're talking about, reporting about, even if it's love or a personal story, is within a political context, and it's going to be saying something. And so to help people figure out what are the cultural moments that shaped you, even if you're just writing about, you know, your weight or how your mother, you know, parented you, if you trace that back, you can see, you know, that's one of the things I started to see, is that, you know, my parents' love affair grew out of this moment in civil rights, but how my grandparents responded to that grew out of them coming to America. And I saw that each generation, as they became more American, they became less revolutionary, and they became more caught up in the American dream, which then allowed them to throw my mother out of the house when she became pregnant by a black man, which is something they would have never done a generation before. So seeing how the national narrative then ended up shaping families and how they treated people, I think that all of our stories are, in fact, dealing with these issues, and so we need to be paying attention to that. We need to be examining our lives, and that will de facto comment on the moment of time we're in.
I second that. I mean, it's funny. I was thinking that I tell students or ask students to write towards the unknown, to sort of surrender to what they're making and what wants to be told through them. But I also know that there are times we write poems for particular occasions. If you're commissioned to write a poem, we write poems for different events and write pieces for different events and for different audiences. And so that sense of the possibility of both, on the one hand, writing towards the unknown, and on the other hand, writing towards, go straight for the particular moment or event. And I don't think that that means that one doesn't attend to craft, mm-hmm. that it's possible to attend to craft at the same time that you're going straight for it. Mm-hmm. And there's this really curious, to me, divide, curious sense that it's not possible to do a kind of well-wrought polemic. It is. I mean, think of Swift. Yeah. That it is possible to do those things.
But I wonder if it's particular to certain forms. If only, I mean, because I think I'm closer aligned with what Amy was answering, just because we're fiction writers, but there's such a sense, George Saunders was just talking about overdetermined narratives, you know, for fiction writers, when there's a meaning that's established in the beginning, and that as being something to be wary of. And you know, I try to do myself and with my students this act of discovering meaning along the way. So it means putting a check on that part of you that's desperate to get something across to the reader, and just sort of, you know, witnessing it, you know, and then discovering what that thing is, you know, and then believing that it will have more power because it's earned its place in that way. But it's just, I think that if I was a poet, you know, and if I was writing nonfiction, because I have written nonfiction, and that it was slightly different. But do you want to talk to that, Leslie? You
know, sure. Well, I also just want to say that I think the call to write towards the unknown is about making space within the work for discovery.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. So I'm going to amplify a little bit of what Faith and also what Tanya were just saying. I absolutely cannot sit down in the morning to write without the full and complete belief that I'm doing my best to be a person of my time. And I think that we're all called as writers to be people of our times. And I talk to my students about this at length. I have a lot of young memoirists in my creative nonfiction workshops, and in the workshops I teach outside of our college, and I see this lure and pull towards the personal, which of course I love, but I also really try to press on this idea that if we're not discovering the world in which we live, if we're not responding to the world in a tactile, hard-edged way, we're missing out on so many opportunities to discover more about that I as we back off the I and we can see all the other things happening around it. I think just to speak a little bit about being political people in these times, those of us who do remember very in fine detail the 80s, I actually moved out of the United States and reported the news abroad for 2.5 years because I was a young reporter and felt that that's what you did when things weren't going your way. Now I'm not so inclined to turn and move abroad. I'm more inclined to stay here and have a say about things. But I do remember the terror people felt when Reagan aligned himself with the Christian right, which was new. That had not happened before. And how people, my father, he's still with us, he's no longer writing, is a conservative columnist. And he won a Pulitzer Prize for those types of opinions. And it was a type of conservatism that's nothing like what you see today, where it's so aligned with this idea of religiosity. It's fascinating to me to observe what's going on now. But, you know, this idea of, you know, back to, just to back up a second, this idea of discovery in our work, I mean, I think as writers, and I imagine most people are here this morning with this panel to, you know, place yourselves into your own writing in a more specific way, right? To understand more of how you're thinking of your own writing, how you're thinking of yourself as a writer in the 21st century. And yeah, I mean, I think come to that moment where you sit down at your desk first thing in the morning or late at night, whenever you do, and think about who you are as a person of your times and how that translates to the page. And it can be something very gentle. I mean, look at Rachel Carson. You know, look at Rachel Carson's writing. There's a beautiful gentleness to her prose. Look at George Orwell. There's a simple statement of fact. And if you read his essay, Politics in the English Language, he just calls what he sees. And that's the craft. You know, the craft is in the nuance and the discovery and the fearlessness to look at the world with those eyes, I think.
Yeah. I also think it's possible when I think about writing towards the unknown. I mean, I get nervous about the solid I, the unchanging I, the hardened subject position. I think that part of the craft is opening up the possibilities for who one might be. And that even in writing in the present, you're leaving open the possibility of writing to future audiences simultaneously. Mm-hmm. And so it means certainly going for it, but discovering exactly what it is in the course of the writing.
And to follow up on that, I have one last quick question, then we'd like to open it up for questions from the audience. But so one of those things was that was interesting for me when my last book, which is a book of stories, came out, was I felt when I got my reviews and heard from readers like I was on a therapist couch, because I felt like whatever I thought about it, there's a whole new level, which is it's really a collaborative project. We write and people read, you know, and they bring their own experiences to it. And then when they read it, we learn so much from how they're reading it, and they're just as legitimate. Whatever our intentions are, you know, have to join up with. So I'm wondering if you all had that experience, if you can talk about that sense of, you know, when I talk about this as being self-discovery, there's this, you know, this growing sense of who I am. Well, now a reader reads it and says, no, this is what you are, you know, and isn't that legitimate that they get the right after spending that time with your book? Amy, do you want to talk about that? Or you looked like you're, or whoever wants to talk about it. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's part of the wonder and joy of being a writer is engaging with how people see your ideas. The first half of my career was in journalism exclusively. And so, you know, sometimes I was writing 4 or 5 stories a day, And I was getting a lot of feedback from people all the time about things. Even if it was something like a story about chocolate ganache cake. No, that's not the best way to make it. And and so I'm very porous about comments. I feel so thrilled that after years, like Amy, I'm a very slow writer. My second book is coming out in February. It's about the Presidio. And I had somebody recently say to me, when was the first book published? And I was like, do we need to go there, really? So I just feel thrilled to sort of emerge from my platonic cave after all those years and have people interested. And I feel, yeah, really honored, you know, to even have that discourse with people, so.
I'm like, ooh, what do I say? I don't feel like I'm on a therapist's couch. I feel like I'm in conversation. And I think of, as my model, all those poets who had multiple editions of the same book in which they changed it over time, over years, and those things. So I think, oh, that's an interesting note for the conversation. I mean, I'm also writing in the margins of my book presently, so that it's becoming this other book. So it's an ongoing conversation for me.
If I remember the question correctly.
Well, what you know, your sense of what your book was, who you were, and what you learned from the way readers responded to it.
Okay. So I write memoir, which is inviting people to think that they know you. And you have to kind of shut that off when you're writing, because you can't write a half-truth. If you're going to write about something, you've got to really be there, be present, show yourself warts and all, and not try to, you know, be the hero of your own story. So you have to kind of shut off that fear that there's an audience to just really engage, sink in, and write it. So I was kind of on that tip. And I got my galleys for the first memoir, and it was right around Christmas, so I sent the galleys to my mom in lieu of a Christmas gift. And she called me, Christmas morning, and she was like, I was up all night reading your book, and oh my God, it's so brave. And I'm like, oh shit. So I like called my agent, and I was like, pull it, let's give the money back. My mom said I was brave. And I was like, what in the hell is in there that my own mom thinks I'm brave? And she's like, and I'm reading it, and I'm like, is she gonna go there? Oh, she went there. And I was like, oh, my mom is speaking like a black lady, like take this stuff. I was terrified. I hadn't really thought that it was gonna land. Like, you know, I was like in my bubble, and I was like, oh, people are gonna read it, and they're gonna know shit, and apparently it's brave. So I was absolutely terrified at that moment, because it was too late. And then that kind of wonderful thing, like if you build it, they'll come. Then people started coming out of the woodwork and saying like, oh, you're not alone in this thing that you thought made yourself vulnerable or made you weak. You're writing for me. You're helping me. And so, you're wrestling with yourself. Like nobody is interested in your story as far as you know. It's completely an act of faith that you know, you're putting aside other things that could be more fun, to write this book because you're possessed. And then the payoff really comes when people come and they want to argue with you, or they engage with it, or they forget that you're just a character on the page and they're like emailing you saying like, hey, I'm going to Thailand. Where should I eat? You know, just like all of it. They think they're in relationship with you. Which is kind of fantastic, because that means it's succeeded, and that the reason we wrote, which was to be in conversation, to be community, and to create the people we want to be with and the conversations we'd like to have out in the world, has happened. So it's a kind of a stunning change.
Yep. One last thing, just because it's just so interesting to get to put your memory, as you said, and find out. When I said originally the therapy thing, I had people that were more astute about me than I was about me. I mean, I think they were saying things that were, it, you know, it wasn't like fan stuff. Oh, I liked it. They were, this is how I see this particular story, this particular world. And I was like, wow.
Yeah.
And I suddenly had an insight into, because I write from a place of mystery. Like I'm not, I just know my characters are messed up in a particular way and I just follow them, but I don't set out fully understanding them. And I felt like, wow, this is really interesting stuff, you know, and that was strange to me. So
that's the great thing also. Like like visiting college campuses where they've like really studied it and analyzed it and taken it apart and compared it to other things. Or I remember the first times when I was reading about kind of my experiences with our tribe during the Nigerian Civil War, and then people would come up to me and say, this is where I was when we first saw the starving Biafran children, or my family survived the Holocaust, and these are the connections I see. And so that's super exciting to see the literary and political ramifications of what you think is just a tiny personal story.
That's right.
So my first book was a collection of short stories. It was about... and they were all, each story is told from a different character's point of view, and it surrounds the events of Operation Babylift, which was the evacuation of Vietnamese and half-Vietnamese orphans from Vietnam before the end of the war. And so when I wrote it, it was honestly like in graduate school, I was writing one short story at a time thinking I could cobble together a novel, right? And this was an experiment. And what ended up happening was, it's a book that is that gets taught pretty regularly in Vietnamese American studies classes and ethnic studies classes because, first of all, short stories are easy for students to read. They're like these bite-sized nuggets, so it's not like this big novel that you're gonna, which is hard. I know as a teacher, I love teaching short stories because I know students will read them and it'll be much better discussion. So what ends up happening is I'll get emails from students, or I will find on YouTube people putting up productions of the stories or dramatic reenactments. And it's been 14 years now, so it's been really fascinating to watch how the criticism and the analysis has changed. And the book has suddenly become this historical artifact that's frozen in the 1990s, and it's a 1990s perspective of the Vietnam War and how Vietnamese have dealt with it. So it's really interesting how students will read me their papers, or they'll send me their papers or ask questions. And of course they make you seem way smarter than you felt when you wrote it, because you write, and it's true, the reader completes the story. Yeah. They bring the analysis, they bring the social and historical context, they make you smarter and complete, like this is what you were trying to do. And I can honestly say to them, like, you're the one that did that work.
Yeah.
You know, you're the one that found that. And that's, that for me, that it's not as therapeutic as much more like this political and social conversation that I think is really interesting about history. Like, I can write it, and I can write when I think these are specific characters who are going through these personal pains, and then it's the student who can take it and say, actually, you're speaking about a larger societal issue about these broken families that happened because of this large war. Like, so many families had been broken up.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. No, I love that. And just to amplify what Amy was saying, so I'm a huge fan of sci-fi, and Jeff Vandermeer's X, the trilogy, was made into a film recently called Annihilation. And the writer, Jeff, was interviewed about how he felt about having a film made, because the film varies from the story. And he said he loved having a text that sat alongside his own text that both mirrored it and amplified it and then took it in a different direction. And I think that that's what it feels like when people interpret your work. I had a student at Cornell who was doing a PhD about Antarctic humanities, and he was including my book, and he interviewed me about it, and I thought, oh, I wouldn't have interpreted it that way. But the way Vandermeer caught this idea that there's this sort of shimmering moment, you know, which is kind of an image from the book and the film, where these things exist together in synchronicity, but yet they're different.
Yeah.
I love that.
Yeah. Well, I think we'd love to allow you guys in for a few. How much more time do we have here now?
About 20 minutes.
Oh, we do. Okay. Oh, okay. Good. Well, let's bring in some questions maybe from the audience, nonetheless. Yeah. Oh, my. Oh, here. And I can be loud if I need to. How do I? There we go.
Okay. Do you have a question? I have to hold it, apparently.
Oh, you have to hold it? Oh, okay. Hi. I've read a lot of books about writing and taking courses and everything, and the sort of the formulaic thing is that you have a conflict and then there's a turning point and a resolution. And I guess what I found is that, you know, in reality it doesn't work like that. And so for my writing, it's a problem, and then the turning point isn't like one big thing. It's like a gradual thing, and then the And then the learning, it's not all of a sudden you're cured and like all of a sudden you're an expert on this. I mean, life is more like, yeah, you grow a little and you learn some things, but you still have problems, right? And so it doesn't make a very good story, because I know people want to hear like, wow, I can do this. She got over this and that's great. And I'm going to, so you want to inspire. But so how do you deal with that and that, you know, of wanting to inspire, but the reality is, everything isn't fixed to one, you know. A lot of books want to say that, like, now I'm strong, now I can do it, you can do it too, but I don't find that to be the truth.
Yeah, so I'll just very, very briefly, then I'll pass this down. So books that tie it all up really neatly, where there's an epiphany, I rarely can read and get through. I appreciate the fact that the world's a complex place and nuanced writing is what best reflects that reality. So keep going with your story. And I wouldn't be overly concerned about that. I mean, if there are people, I think, who do genuinely feel like there are these epiphany moments, and now there's like just this whole trope of unhappiness that's been going on for so long. Those books, I love them because I hate them so much, you know? I mean, come on. But anyway, I'll pass this down.
I was going to say that I think of, as a kid, I was in a class with Ellis Marsalis, and he would teach me to listen to the blues so that I could one day write about it. Mm-hmm. And I feel like there's a way of thinking about that notion of the story, like the epiphanic moment, the moment when things are cured. I'm much more interested in taking the sorrow and making it swing. Mm-hmm. And that the beauty becomes that kind of complicated thing that is this kind of tension between, like, you read Toni Morrison's Beloved, right? Mm-hmm. This beautiful language, these sort of unexpected sentences, and yet it's a book of terrific grief. Mm-hmm. And that's how we get through. We don't get through by the kind of illusion of a perfect solution or perfected solution. Mm-hmm. But we get through by getting through.
Mm-hmm. I'm trying to follow myself.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah. Well, we have to do a perfect four.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, a couple more questions.
Who, what?
The audience. Are you writers? Or?
Yeah. How many here are writers working on projects?
How many of you are working on nonfiction projects?
How many on fiction?
Any poets in the crew?
Yay!
Teachers? Well, Amy, you know, I asked in advance. I got some things from folks that they were sending in to me about themselves, and I remember you said something, but just posed to everybody about having a connection to place, and you said it was more the people and less the physical place. Mm-hmm. Although California is big to you, but I guess talking about and Leslie, I think of you and I think of place. You know, writing about place, but just I guess that set. We always, one of the first things in a fiction class I do is try to get people to understand setting on a number of different levels. But I guess, you know, what does place mean to you? And that can be a political thing as well as a sort of physical thing, but, you know, and a social thing. So maybe address that aspect of your writing and your place within it.
Yeah. Sure. I think it's funny, like, I am super attached to California. Like, the idea of leaving California, I don't ever want to. I think I was born here, and my parents got really lucky. Like, well, first of all, like, most of my family, like, we talk about the history of the fact that a huge part of my family, my entire family and my community, we were exiled from our country. And I think I grew up with always this idea of loss. Like, we will never be able to return to the homeland, because growing up in the 1980s, we never thought we could go back. Now, the opposite is true. Right now I have colleagues and friends who live in Vietnam who thrive there. My cousin, whose family spent years trying to escape, like 10 years, getting jailed, trying to come up with different escape plans. Now he lives in Singapore with his wife, who works for Google, but that's the closest he can be to Vietnam, and he goes there every month to study with musicians. That is how much has changed in 40 years. But back then, I remember my mother always saying to me, like, we will never be able to go back. And so the idea of Vietnam became just a memory, like a memory that a loss that I never had. And so California, like a lot of Vietnamese Americans became attached to California because of the ocean, because of the water, and being close to it, even if you never went there. Like, we lived in Irvine, which was 20 minutes away, and we would go to the ocean like maybe twice a year, which was silly. But knowing it was there, knowing that on the other side of that ocean was Vietnam, was really significant to my family. And I think the reason why I mentioned social was the way we are perceived and the way we are made to feel comfortable in our setting. When my parents first came here, they just had to make do with the fact that people were not looking at them very nicely, right? They had to make do with the fact that they were smaller than everybody else. They were some of the first. They came here, and my dad came here in the late 60s, and so did my mom. And so they were like one of the first, you know, Vietnamese refugees here. So they grew up feeling, they spent a majority of their lives feeling like people were looking at them always strangely, always knowing to stand on the margins, never taking up enough big space. Of course, now Irvine is like, my goodness, there's a sushi restaurant, like pho restaurants on every block now. Like, they would be so comfortable there now. So for me, it was about how welcomed I was in my setting. That was a huge thing. And so that is why the people was so important. Not necessarily the habitat, but like, am I going to feel safe here? Am I going to feel welcomed? Or am I going to feel like I have to leave? And so that's why the social became really important. And I think in my stories, like, and in my novel, people react more to the way they are treated or the way they feel perceived to be treated. And so I feel like setting is very much that place, and that's why dialogue becomes so important to me, and people's faces and body expressions more than anything else. And that was something I had to really work on in my writing. I would have to write it in my notes, like, don't forget the natural setting. Don't forget to talk about the sights and smells, because for so many years of my life, I was always focused on the people. Like, are you going to allow me to stay here? And are you going, you know, and am I, and now I'm, you know, I'm 40 now, like, if you give me an evil look, I will give you an evil look back and be like, no, I'm okay here. Like, I'm much more confident. But I think for my characters, that is certainly something they have to grapple with.
Yeah, and just for those of you who are writing fiction, I mean, that is the distinction with, you know, novels and stories is having to, if you don't create that world, the reader's not necessarily going to see it. You assume it because you see it when you're writing those scenes, but it's not there if it isn't there. So, yeah. Faith.
I can relate so much to that because I grew up not paying attention to where I was with a grandmother who was in exile. And so, you know, I grew up in this very kind of forbidding landscape in rural Washington State. And we knew that, like, over the hills in Seattle, over the mountain range in Seattle, there were people who read books. So the whole idea was to, like, get over the mountains to them. And we were not paying attention to where we were. My grandmother was always moping about everyone who was left back in Finland in the home country. And so I grew up with this exile that, like, I, too, am an exiled Viking girl. And my father wasn't there, you know, disappeared to Nigeria. So I was in double exile, and no one was like me. So I had these, you know, fantasies that this, like, strange Nigerian Viking creature would, like, come over the mountains and be like, come on, girl, this is the way out. and that didn't happen, so I had to leave. But PBS did a documentary about my family called My Journey Home. And so, you know, we went back home, then we went to Nigeria, and then I brought 60 of my friends to my town for my mom's birthday. And so everyone's like, you know, where's home now? And I was like, this is it. Everyone who's like newly immigrant or mixed or who has one foot in one world and one in the other, that's the home that I've created. But there's no homeland. There's no space. I mean, I went to Nigeria and it was great, but it's like, I can't live there. I went to Finland and that was cold, and that's, you know, and I love my cousins, but that's not home either. And so then I just realized it's this new world, it's this new space that's mobile, and it's people like me who are mobile, and so that was really the place. Since then, I've become very active in the travel writing movement, and I teach the only workshop for travel writers of color in the country, and then I edit a couple of columns for travel magazines that are tasked with introducing travel writers of color, because so much of the world that's visited is written about by a very elite group of people, and that shapes our world. And so that's the whole thing of the place will be different depending on whose body is there, who they're interacting with, how they're being observed. And so that's really how I'm interested in writing about place and changing the conversation about place.
For me, I'm often thinking about how we sound differently depending on where we are and with whom we're talking. So we have regional accents, of course. We have national languages and those things. And so I'm interested in how we move between those spaces. And I write about place, but I also write out of place. So that my book, I lived in New York for a number of years, and I was in a third floor apartment in a 6-story building. And so I was right at, I guess, the sweet spot to get all the street noise. And so as a part of the work, that street noise filters into the work, the sort of rhythms of street life filters into the work, those sounds. I'm also very interested in different registers of language and how they reflect a kind of emplacement. I saw that.
Oh, no.
I don't know.
We've got time. Yeah.
No, just, and it's signals a kind of emplacement. That's all.
It's great. Yeah. So, you know, I'm a research scholar as well as a writer, and I'm all about place. My central question is, how do we place ourselves in a landscape, and what do we do when we get there? And it's a question that sounds rather banal, and it's incredibly meaningful to me. And it means very specific things. I have it written on a note over my desk. I don't separate people from place. I see us all as part of, an ecosystem. And I think it's to our own peril that we do imagine the fabric of human society and identity as being separate. I see the hegemony of that. I see it as a very capitalist and kind of macho view on how the earth functions. And I'm not trying to sound like, my Greenpeace buddy circa 1972. But I really do think we live in these times now where there's an incredible shift that's going on. So to amplify what Faith was just saying about finding a place or deciding where the place is and being sort of mobile, I do believe that we're in a phase where we're shifting towards a nomadic type of existence. It's going to become more so, probably not in our lifetimes, but because of how the weather is going to be changing, and weather is just one piece of this larger thing called climate change. I mean, I was in the Antarctic in 1988, and that was at a time when we referred to it in this very charming way. It was called global warming then. And I remember when I would write about it for newspapers, people thought it was kind of charming. They'd say things like, oh, I wouldn't mind it if it was warmer here in the winter. It's like, well, it's actually not going to be like that from what the scientists are saying. So, yeah, I mean, I guess I have kind of an outlier perspective on all of this. I can't put things into super neat categories that way. I just don't think about the world that way. And I guess one of the things I'd say to everybody who's writing, I think it's really important to break free from any of the scaffolding that you're presented with of, like, this is how a story is structured, this is how you do X, Y, or Z. I think you start there and you get that, and then you start riffing. So to pick up or amplify what Tanya was saying about the Marsalises, this notion of jazz, the reason people are good at jazz is because they know what their tune is. They are thinking through. And if you look at somebody's brain and how it's functioning when they're playing jazz, their brain is going into really fascinating places. And I think with writing, when we're improvising, that's probably the same sort of thing. So I don't know if any of that made sense, but yeah, it's a hugely important topic about relational. Our human relational identity to place, to me, is first and foremost where all of our brains should be right now, given what's happening with the climate.
What I would follow up on everyone is saying, then, in light of all of you who are writing and thinking about place, I think these writers are such a good example of this, is that there is some corner of the world that's yours that you know better than anybody else. And while you're writing, to understand that you are the correspondent for that little street, that house, that particular time, you know, that place. And if you know, and you know it, and you feel it, and you are the right person to tell that story. And I think all these writers are people that found that. They found their voice through a particular thing as, I'm sorry, this is mine. And I think I've done that to an extent, and I think that's part of that discovery. But I think all of you have that, and with our writers, I think it's like we try to point them in that direction rather than constantly trying to be something else. Is there some place that you have that nobody else is, that's yours? And I think so much of the experience, right, of who we're becoming is discovering that, and that's, we tell that better than anyone, right?
Can I add to
add to that?
I mean, I think. One of the things I think about plays, right? I used to joke with my mom when I would go home.
Can you hold the microphone closer?
Yes. I used to joke with my mom when I'd go home to visit New Orleans. Oh, you've got to drive me around to take pictures of the places we used to live, because one day this is like Atlantis, and it will be underwater, and no one will believe it was here. And then it was underwater. And we went back to those places, and I took more photographs. And I realized I had been sort of, I used to say that New Orleans was like the city through which all other senses of place came to me. My understanding of all other senses of place came to me. And so there's a way that there's that place that may be the originary place, but it becomes actually the place in your head, in your mind, the place as you remember it. Mm-hmm. And that becomes the location, the kind of sounding board. And it doesn't exist beyond your experiences of it. Because certainly the New Orleans I knew is gone, mm-hmm. as home always is behind us or in front of us. We're never quite there. So just add that thought.
No, I think that's a great point to end on, I guess. But I just wanted to thank this terrific panel and thank you all for coming out on this Saturday morning. And do we know, are there books out there or not? Yeah, there are. So terrific books out there. Authors will sign. And thank you so much, volunteers. Yeah. So.
We hope you enjoyed this podcast from the 2018 Bay Area Book Festival. For more podcasts, please go to www.baybookfest.org.